If people are dieting now more than ever before, then why are nearly 1 in 3 American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier than ever, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs are a special kind of compound that, instead of turning into fat when you consume it, turns into ketones, which is a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body. So, by getting more MCTs in your diet, you essentially flip a switch that puts your body in caloric bypass mode, which can flush out excess fat and calories. And he's created an easy way for you to activate caloric bypass right at home. It's called MCT Wellness. This powerful blend of fat-flushing MCT powders and antioxidant-rich polyphenols is designed to help you unlock your body's fat-burning, energy-producing potential. What's even better is that it's a delicious drink. I love how incredible it tastes. All you do is add a scoop to water, enjoy, and watch as you start feeling slimmer and more energized. So, if you want to experience a quick, easy, and effective way to melt pounds fast, go to GundryMD.com/energy and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's GundryMD.com/energy.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, I'm Matt Lieb.
And I'm Vince Mancini.
And this is Pod Yourself the Wire. The Wire podcast, where Vince Mancini and I go through every single episode of The Wire
and talk about it.
Thank you for listening to the world's only The Wire podcast, where we talk about HBO's The Wire, a show about how Irishmen will literally put their career at risk to conduct a month-long wiretap instead of going to therapy. Make sure that you give us 5 stars and a review on all of the podcast apps out there, 5 stars on Spotify and all that shit, so that people know about it. And tell your friends, right? Because we want your friends to listen to us, too.
And
so
their friends.
Yeah, that way you grow closer as friends.
Yeah, we're building community, fun and community.
We're trying to build a community. Also, here is just a quick shout out for an event you can go to on Thursday, September 22nd in Quad Cinema in New York City. There will be a screening of a short film that I was in.
Oh, wow.
Listener,
I hope it's really short.
It is short. It's like I think 20 minutes long. Listener and friend Colin Kornfind, he is longtime listener of The Frot and of course of Pod Yourself a Gun, and he casted me to play a ayahuasca demon named Kevin. And
sounds
he's
cool.
Doing a preview screening for friends and family and everything, and yeah, I would like people to show up. It's a free screening. All you got to do is show up, and it's at 7:30 Thursday, September 22nd, 7:30 p.m. Quad Cinema. Please go see What a Trip. It's a wonderful film in which I play a demon. All right. So today, Vince and I and a very special guest will be talking about, from season 1, episode 3 of The Wire, The Buys, which premiered on June 16th, 2002.
A landmark in bisexual visibility.
Nope, not what it
is. Oh, okay, no, the other kind? Yeah.
It's about The Buys? No, it's about The Buys as in bust, buy bust. It's when you buy drugs and then you bust later. We're not talking about busting right now. Our guest today, you know him from Conan, and you know him from the podcast Out for Smokes. Ladies and gentlemen, our guest is Mike Racine.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you back on one of our fucking rewatch podcasts, man.
Yeah, so you finished Sopranos, I guess, huh?
We finished it. It's all done. There's no more episodes to talk about. So we're like, well, what's next? And we're like, you know, it's a good show. Yeah. The Wire.
Yeah. I wonder what's next after The Wire.
I mean, honestly, Downton Abbey, if I have it my way.
Okay. We'll have to discuss that one. I do like Downton Abbey. I'm not going to lie.
It's such a good show. It's like one of those shows that you would immediately expect everyone to be like, Downton Abbey, I'm not going to watch that shit just so I can listen to your podcast. But I implore people, watch Downton Abbey. You will be like, oh, fuck, I need a podcast.
No, I think it's the first like masterpiece theater type British show that doesn't look like it was filmed on like someone's cousin's camcorder. And therefore, like... Like you realize how good British shows could have been all along if somebody gave a shit about production values at all.
If one guy had a good camera, just one. It's like an island filled of ugly people and people who don't know how to like buy good cameras. It's very strange, but the writing is fantastic. The acting is fantastic, and it's a great show, but not as good as The Wire, right, guys?
No.
Yeah. So, Mike, do you like The Wire?
I do. Yeah, I watched this season. I watched season one when I was in high school, and then it's one of those shows I've just kind of like slowly made my way through. I still haven't seen season five. But it's cool. But I've heard mixed things about season five.
Nah, it's good. They're all good.
Season five is one. I also heard mixed things before I even watched it. Someone was like, it goes a little off the rails in season five. Mm-hmm. And
wait, is that the newspaper? Like, is that the newspaper one?
It's a newspaper one. It's the one with the serial killer and whatnot.
Just the like shady the guy who talks about the Dickensian aspect. I forget what that reporter's name is, but
Gus.
Yeah, that piece of shit makes the whole season for me.
Oh, you mean Scott. Scott Templeton. There's like a journalist who lies and does fake news, which I think is awesome. And there's like McNulty, basically, in order to stop all the like drug killings that no one gives a shit about.
Spoil the whole season for him.
Okay, all right. I'm not going to spoil it.
Just know that there's a piece of shit named Scott Templeton.
It's a 20-year-old show.
That's what I think. It's a 20-year-old show. Yeah. I'm going to try not to spoil it for people like, you know, too far in the... But I feel like...
Yeah.
I don't know,
Ian Fidance is watching Sopranos right now, and he's like, no spoilers. I don't want to know what happens. And it's just silly to be like, don't spoil a 20-year-old show for me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, especially all the episodes are out. If you can't say that for longer than a month. Binge it. Like, what the fuck?
You should have some of it spoiled for you because...
Oh, yeah.
And that'll make you... If you can have some of the show spoiled and you still watch it, that's...
Well, also, at a certain point, if you haven't watched it yet, each of those spoilers is just like an additional kick in the ass to go watch the show. Like, those are teasers, and you gotta tease more and more for the people who haven't watched yet, so, you know.
Yeah.
And it's not a fucking Shyamalan film. It's not like there's a surprise. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, I think, like, HBO kind of did a little bit invent the we're gonna kill a main character thing and that's what's gonna keep you going is not knowing who can die, but like at a certain point, you know, you're just like, okay, I've accepted the fact that anyone can die. If someone gets killed that I like, it's not really a surprise as much as it is
except Jon Snow. He's gonna come back.
Sometimes you come back to life.
That's right.
Because in season three, they kill a pretty big character, and it's like he gets cornered by two of his like enemies.
Right.
I don't know now I'm trying not to spoil the show. I'm not going to spoil it. But he gets, and you're like, oh, how's he going to get out of this? And they just murder him.
Right. Yeah.
And you're like, well, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it is like, it's interesting to go into a show completely blind the way I think that's the way it's intended. But if that in any way ruins this show, especially The Wire for you, then I feel like you're not really enjoying what's good about The Wire.
Right.
Like, what's good about The Wire isn't like what's good about fucking, you know, the Game of Thrones or some shit. Like, what you should really be looking at is not the deaths, but all the like bureaucracy and all of the bad haircuts. Yeah. You know, yeah. Like that's
a fun for the whole family.
The bad accents.
Yeah.
Yeah. Shitty accents.
That's what my 9-year-old stepson, he's always like, you know, I want to see something that has more bureaucracy, more bad accents, more machinations of a failed city. You know,
I want to see some long and plotting conflicts that are systemic and never resolved.
Some
that's
wheezy, excessively depicted sex between people who are like kind of hot, but.
But like not hot enough that you're like, well, I definitely need to see this, but just hot enough that you're like, well, I don't mind. See, that's, I think that's my sexuality.
Yeah. When someone's too hot, I don't really get that horny when someone's like excessively hot.
100%.
You know,
100%.
You want them, I want them to look like real people.
Rhonda Perlman.
It's hotter if they have like
hot.
A couple hot things about them and then like a couple like.
Oh, Rhonda Perlman. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Couple
she's really
ugly
hot.
Things about them so that you feel dirty. You like you're horny for them, but you feel a little bit dirty about it. That's the way it should be.
I at this point don't even watch well-produced porn anymore. Like I saw one recently that was like shot in a car, which and it felt like it was shot on someone's phone that was just being held up, and the woman who was getting fucked, she had two different socks on. And I was like, that's the hottest thing I've ever seen. I was like, that is the realest shit. Just like unmatched socks, having sex in the back of a car that's real, dude.
Yeah.
That's real. It was wonderful. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm getting a little horny.
Who do you think was the hottest, just to sidetrack a little bit, who do you think was the hottest woman in Sopranos?
Oh, God. There was a few, like, I mean.
I think mine is Charmaine Bucco.
Yeah, Charmaine is definitely up there. She's, you know. She's got a very Italian face. No offense to anybody, but a little too Italian. You know, I think for me,
maybe
the hottest...
shitting on our point, but I mean, Julianne Margulies in The Sopranos was pretty damn good. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, she was. You know,
she could have been uglier. She could have been a little uglier. Would have been nice.
Yeah, she's also too Italian, but in a beautiful way. I think the hottest one was the stripper that Ralphie kills.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I thought she was just because I like that she also baked. That was it's kind of hot.
Oh yeah, she made bread for Tony.
Yeah, she made him bread. I mean, you know, that's I like I don't know skills.
And why does he turn it down? He's like, I can't bring that home to my family or some weird reason.
Yeah, for some reason he like. It's like for once in his life, he's like, this is one stripper I'm not going to fuck. I think it was because
he's like, I need to assert boundaries in my position as the head of the strip club.
Yeah. It's the first time where I was just like, come on, man, just do it. Yeah. She's like, she's really trying here. You know, you're
if
making
he would
her
have,
feel
bad. Yeah. And if he would have, you know, made him his Gumar, like maybe Ralphie doesn't beat her to death in the parking lot with the
that's
with the chain.
Very good point. Yeah. That's a very good point. He could have saved her life.
He could have saved her.
Yeah. Dude, it's like that Phil Collins song, the theme from Tarzan.
How to save a life.
Oh, that that one. But this is not a Sopranos podcast. No.
Sorry.
This is a The Wire podcast. And we, of course, cannot start the podcast without first playing the theme song.
Through the garden, you better watch your back. Well, I beg your
pardon.
Want to stay in
podcast?
Track. If you
pod
to Jesus, he'll save you.
The Wire.
You gotta keep the devil
pod
down in the hole.
Pod.
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 Down in the hole.
All right, ladies and gentlemen and everyone else, today, once again, we're going to be talking about from episode 1 of The Wire, Oh, it's from season one of The Wire, episode 3, The Buys. And Vince, can you break us off a little piece of that synopsis?
I sure can. Let me read this official synopsis that Matt Lieb definitely did not write himself.
Mm-hmm.
McNulty puts his grubby little wiener inside Rhonda Perlman. Also, D'Angelo Barksdale teaches his underlings chess while the police teach their underlings checkers.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
Yeah, you got some poetry in there. That's nice.
Yeah, I had like a little bit. I had like a good one, but I was like, well, I gotta mention McNulty's grubby little wiener. And this episode premiered June 16th, 2002. What was happening at the time that this episode came out, Vince?
Yeah, I think what you're trying to say is that when we evaluate any piece of art, we need to understand its cultural context. And
absolutely,
to put some of that back in, we go to the back in the day machine.
It's a bad time for newspapers, as you all know. The news hole is shrinking as advertising dollars continue to decline, and the internet is a free source of news and opinions.
Machine tells the tale, son.
That's right. We're going all the way back to June 16th, 2002. We had a lot of news stories that were very relevant to our subject matter of this week's The Wire. Starting with from the New York Times, records show an FBI focus on terrorism.
Cut straight from the episode.
Mm-hmm. Justice Department data released yesterday showed that the Federal Bureau of Investigation's focus on terrorism has produced a surge in cases classified as terrorism and a decline, at least temporarily, in the prosecution of more traditional federal crimes like drug trafficking, bank robbery, and bank fraud.
It's kind of crazy that bank robbery still happened and still happens now.
I know. You got to respect it. It's like a throwback crime, you know? Like,
it was a bad time to be a terrorist.
Yeah,
they were really cracking down on you.
It was the worst time, I think. Mm-hmm. Everything before 9/11, it was a pretty sick time to be a terrorist, because you could kind of you know, people would be like, "Damn, that's
kinda
crazy."
Just live your life.
Yeah. You live your life and then live your death, and then like no one's like gonna fucking fuck with your family or whatever. But
Carlos
now, everyone,
the Jackal, everybody liked him. They thought he was cool. They gave him a cool nickname. You know?
Yeah, terrorists actually, you know, for a while there, I feel like America was like, "Oh, that's crazy," but I get it. Whereas, like, then 9/11 happened, and everyone all of a sudden were against terrorism. It's fucking bullshit, really.
Yeah.
It's like whenever things go mainstream, man, I feel like people always turn on it. Yeah. It's fucked up.
But the data show that many of the 945 terrorism cases referred by the FBI and other federal agencies since September 11th involved minor charges over false documents or immigration rules, and that United States attorneys had declined to prosecute half of the cases.
Jesus Christ. It's so, but like, what they're like giving parking tickets, classifying it as terrorism.
Yeah, I mean, he looked at Middle Eastern.
Yeah.
Similar, this one is a little more tangential, but also important to the culture that's happening around this time. Bush to formalize a defense policy of hitting first.
Will he?
President Bush has directed his top national security aides to make a doctrine of preemptive action against states and terrorist groups, trying to develop weapons of mass destruction into the foundation of a new national security strategy. Iraq is clearly first on the target list for such action, and already the Central Intelligence Agency and the Defense Department have stepped up efforts to unseat Saddam Hussein in a last effort to avoid the necessity of a full-scale invasion. Yes, I'm sure that was.
We really don't. We don't want to have to do it.
Yeah, yeah. Why are you hitting yourself rule?
My theory about 9/11 is that I feel like Osama bin Laden probably didn't think that the buildings were going to collapse. He probably just wanted to fly some planes into them.
Right. Yeah.
And then so I bet when they collapsed, he was like, "Holy shit!
Oh, I'm in trouble."
Yeah.
Oh no! Yeah. Oh no!
Shit. Oh fuck!
Oh, dude, it was a prank, bro.
Oh, shit.
Fucking hey, dude! We just wanted to visit the top of the building and just kind of like go. There's a gift shop there. Fuck.
Because they weren't supposed to. But then if you could tell him now that we're still taking our shoes off at the airport, you know?
Yeah, he'd be like, "Oh, I won."
I fucking won.
Wow, crazy. Yeah. He watches like Loose Change and is just like, there's definitely some thermite in there.
Well,
I didn't do that.
He was
like, that wasn't me.
That wasn't me,
the thing collapsing wasn't me.
Yeah. Flying the planes, yeah, but that's normal.
He's pulling a Daniels. He just wants to dip his toe into, like, busting the Barksdale crew, but before he knows it, he's all the way in. You know, they got wires set up. They're all the way into the towers.
His boss is mad, a.k.a. the Saudi government.
And one last story. This one goes back to maybe our previous series, but this was the day after John Gotti's funeral.
Shit. R.I.P.
Yeah.
Gotti, what did he die of again?
Gotti goes to underworld. Fans of Dead Don mob his burial rites in Queens. Dapper Don John Gotti got a clapping, cheering. Sorry, I thought they were going to tell us how he died. He died in a hospital in Springfield, Missouri at age 61 on Monday after battling cancer for 4 years. He got a clapping, cheering, and weeping send-off yesterday from wise guys, wannabes, and ordinary fellas who filled the streets as the outlaw hero took his final ride.
Yeah, that was like the final like sequence in the movie Gotti, where everyone was like, hey, in this neighborhood, he's a hero. Thanksgiving.
Yeah, that was the best part of that whole movie.
It really was. That should have just been the movie.
Yeah, that should have been.
Goodbye, John. Goodbye, John, screamed dozens of weeping mourners who banged on the windows of Gotti's hearse when it stopped at one of his old haunts, the Bergen Hunt and Fish Club in Ozone Park, Queens. People ran after the car as it sped off. John Gotti will live forever, read a huge banner unfurled on a Long Island Railroad bridge nearby.
I hope John Travolta plays him in the movie. When that comes out, I'll be like, yeah, that was a manly man, that John.
Well, we all need something to believe in, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
8 pallbearers then carried his bronze casket into a pearl gray hearse. In front of the hearse were 20 limousines carrying spectacular displays of flowers, including a racehorse, cards in a royal flush, a huge brown cigar, and a martini glass with olives.
God, it's just so tacky. I love the tackiness of the mob funeral, like in real life, is just, it's like a sight to behold. It reminds me of like when you see cartel funerals. That like you'll see pictures sometimes and it's just like the entire flower arrangement is just an AK-47 and they like embalm the guy in his long shorts.
Well, there was an episode of The Wire when they did that.
That's
the guy's
right.
Like, hey, let me show you in the back. Yeah, and they all the special arrangements for like gang members.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. They did it there too. I love it, man. Gang funerals, I think that's the reason I would want to join a gang, so I could have a really fun funeral. Mm-hmm.
Behind the hearse were 21 limousines, so that makes 41 total, for family and friends. And behind those two were dozens of other vehicles, bringing the total to about 100.
Damn.
He's the last of the old-time gangsters, said Frank Savino, 46, who was standing outside the funeral home when the procession began to move. He treated the neighborhood good. What he did for a living is his business. Millie Russo, another onlooker, agreed, saying, I don't see anything wrong with the man. He didn't harm people. He went after people in his own business.
I mean, he maxed out my credit card in 1988, but other than that, it was fine.
He was very charismatic.
He lent me $200 in 1981, and now I still owe him 20 grand.
The VIG was only 20.
And he helped me when I needed it.
He helped me. I was down on my luck.
Yeah.
He was very charismatic, a man who always dressed well and always was a real gentleman, said Gina Zadubera. His life of...
Now they're just making stuff up. He was his whole thing was not being a gentleman. That was his like, he looked like good, but he was like a, he was an asshole, famously.
Yeah. Mm. So yeah.
But I guess there's a reason why we know his name and not like other, you know.
Yeah,
because he was bad at doing crimes. He was very, very public and did.
Yeah, he got in trouble for crimes a lot was the problem. But he loved, you know, he liked to be in the media and stuff.
Was he an asshole?
I think he murdered a boss, right?
I mean, yeah, I think that was the whole way that crew began was he just like shot all the bosses at the time, I think.
Yeah, he killed Paul Castellano.
Yeah,
right, exactly. And I feel like, I don't know, the gentlemanly thing to do is not to kill the boss.
Yeah, yeah, for everybody listening, that is our position, official position of Pod Yourself the Wire.
Well, yeah, I mean, although I guess The Wire is a show about wanting to kill your boss, though.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There's footage of him on like some wiretap, and he's like, "You tell him that me, John Gotti, will sever his fucking head off." He's like threatening to cut somebody's head off.
John Gotti of sound mind.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh my God.
Here's today's newspaper that I'm holding up.
April 15th, 1992, tax day. I will not be paying taxes.
But maybe that's why we like him, because he was like kind of a fucking idiot who just like stumbled into this big position.
Oh, yeah.
Those are my favorite mob guys.
He fulfilled our ideas of what like a mob guy should be based on movies, which was also like his reason for acting the way he did,
right.
I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's why we love Trump, right, boys?
Mm-hmm.
It's why that's we right. love him, dude. He's like he's like the president from the movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's been the back in the day machine. I think you guys have enough context now, right? Do you feel
we know what's going on.
Yeah, do you feel culturally contextualized?
Yeah. So, let's talk about this episode.
No more sidelocks. Say goodbye to sidelocks and hello to sidearms.
Yeah.
I can't believe they didn't put that in there. I mean, that would have been.
I know. Yeah. You should have worked for the Post.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about it. The Buys, episode 3. What are our general thoughts of this episode, Vince?
I mean, I thought the great episode, by the way. I think the thrust, this episode written by David Simon, I think this episode is. It's about how the system mostly rewards sociopaths and people that are very ambitious, and that having a conscience or integrity and the capacity for introspection tend to be a hindrance in the corporate environment.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, everybody that has a conscience in this episode, basically, you can sense them about to get fucked. Like D'Angelo, Bubbles, McNulty.
Yeah.
Like they're not going to rise up high in their respective organizations.
They shoot themselves in the foot throughout this episode, and also throughout the full season, in order to like, I don't know, fit an ideal that they have of themselves in their own mind, rather chase that than actually like chase than do good at their job, I guess is what it is, or then advance at their job. So like D'Angelo is he's weak. He's like someone who doesn't fucking understand why violence needs to happen. And I think in any other circumstance, he would have been a cop.
Yeah, he's
his uncle hadn't been Avon.
They all got a little bit of Ned Stark in them, where they want to believe in these like ideals of honor and that things could be better. They're idealists, and they're not maybe cut out for the whole dog eat dog part that keeps them alive.
Mike, what did you think of this episode?
I loved it. I mean, I watched it when I was in. I haven't seen it since I was in high school, so it's cool to experience it when I'm like a little bit smarter, you know, and just know more.
More about stuff.
More about stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No more. I know a little more about business.
Now, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know what a boob feels like and what
money.
It,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I know more about sex. I've had sex.
Ooh, all right.
Know, since watching this show.
Yeah. Lucky you.
is this a first on Pod Yourself the Wire?
Yeah, this is the first time we've had a guest who's had sex.
Who's had sex? Oh, really?
Yeah. Everyone else is a fucking virgin, dude.
Nice.
Yeah.
Cool. It's an honor. I like that D'Angelo's trying to be like a drug dealer with integrity. He's like, why do we have to be mean to them? You know?
Yeah.
And
then
he like doesn't like, he's like, why can't we give them better heroin? Why do we have to give them
heroin? He's like laboring under the delusion that the invisible hand of the market rewards those who like respect the laws of supply and demand and like good customer service, and Stringer's immediately like, that's not what matters. Sorry.
Yeah. What's interesting actually about the scene you're talking about is like, I feel like that also applies to podcast economics. Mm-hmm. Let me just play a clip of that scene.
We'd be doing even better when we get that new podcast.
New
podcast.
Same as old, man. Just gonna put that same shit out in a different color gel cap is all.
People already coming back on us telling us that
slop
is weak.
I know.
Slop
is weak, but you know, the thing is, no matter what we call
the frotcast,
it's gonna get sold. Sit it strong, we're gonna sell it. shit is weak, we gonna sell twice as much. You know why?
Cause a piggy.
You gonna chase that shit no matter what. We do worse, and we get paid more. Right here, D. It's forever.
I feel like that's true of many businesses, but particularly podcasting. I mean, it's just like, you know, this is just our Sopranos podcast, but about The Wire now.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
The fiends are going to chase it no matter what. And right. I feel like that is the general like truth of America is that consumers will consume because it is mm-hmm. their... It is what their duty is, mm-hmm. and it is what their identity is.
People need treats.
People need their treats, whether it's heroin or podcasts. And Dringer understands that the piggies are going to eat the slop no matter what the slop is. But like D'Angelo is, he's like me when we first started the Sopranos podcast. And I was just like, nah, but people want like... production value. They want stings, you know. They want fucking songs. And Vince, you're like Stringer. You were just like, mm-hmm. or you know, just we could do none of
hit the upload button. Yeah,
yeah. Just yeah. Don't even put a theme song in there. Just upload that shit straight into the ears of the pigs.
Don't edit it. Keep the part where you went to the bathroom. Just keep that in the show. Just yeah, have a 3-minute break or you're
3-minute
shit.
Breaks. You hear another conversation happening. The cat jumps up. You just hear it sniffing the mic. Yeah, man. Because the you know the people want it, no matter mm-hmm. what it is. I don't know. In my general thoughts of this episode, I've started to realize the show has started reminding me of the show Fuckboy Island.
Okay.
Have you
okay,
seen go it, on. Does, it could be Fuckboy Island. It could be, I think, any like dating reality show.
Oh, I okay, have seen so Fuckboy Island.
You get 3 episodes into Fuckboy Island and you kind of realize like this is the same episode over and over and over again. Like it's just the same conflict. I really love our connection, but I'm not sure if he's a fuckboy or not. Like literally they will say that at every 30 minutes in the show and in every episode. And it's like the problem is systemic. It's the same thing with what it's like the guys on Fuckboy Island are sociopaths and the girls have low self-esteem. And it's like the same with The Wire. It's like you see throughout this episode and throughout all the seasons the same conflict over and over and over again. And it's what makes the show, I think, feel like a documentary more so than a standard TV show is that like in real life you don't learn anything like you like the in TV it's like every episode whatever conflict happened resolves and within that resolution it's just kind of like okay I won't make that mistake again. But The Wire spends 5 seasons
being like here is why people are going to continue to make the same mistake over
right,
and over again.
Right, cuz like this is the 3rd episode now and I realize the plot lines are essentially the same as they were in the first 2. And that being like the conflict is McNulty wants to do the police work, nobody else is letting him do the police work. And every episode there might be a different reason why they're not letting them do the police work, but it is the same
right.
General conflict.
And also,
in every episode,
David Simon is continuing to just put like he's making this incredible show that's sort of like no other show that we've seen up until this point, but he is still putting in those old school tropes and shit in there. Like he's doing chess as a metaphor in the middle,
right.
Like right as like a centerpiece scene in the show. And that, I mean, like every corny action movie, there's going to be like a chess. Someone, the bad guy's explaining how chess works and they're playing a dangerous game of chess.
Right.
And he does it here, but it somehow works just because he's applied it to groups that we haven't seen like explored in this great of detail.
Yeah. I mean, I think what's great about the chess scene is that it functions in opposition to what's happening with the police. It's like really it is realizing that the police are playing checkers. Like this episode, Burrell is still trying to shut down the detail and he's forcing them to do these raids based on like information that they get that has not implicated anyone who's high up in the Barksdale organization. It's all just like hoppers. You see them at the end of this episode, like busting down a door that was a stash house maybe the day before, but is no longer a stash house. And you realize, like, oh, I see. Like, these guys are playing checkers. They're not trying to do the long game because there's no real incentive to do it. And
right.
That's a much more nuanced point, I think, than like most fucking action movies where it's like explaining what chess is.
You know? Most drug shows, most action movies, you would have the McNulty character who's like a little bit smarter than the other cops, and he would always win in the end. And this right. is like, no, it doesn't really happen.
Yeah, he takes a lot of L's throughout the yeah. series, right?
Oh yeah, it's almost nothing but L's.
You know who's also hot? The lady from Harbor Patrol in the second season.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah, Amy. What's her name?
Amy Ryan, I think.
Amy Ryan.
Right now, though.
Yeah, she's always like she's on some like mature lady hotness
yeah.
where
oh,
you're
yeah.
just like she's a freak in the sack, but also I don't know. I feel like we could talk for a while. You know, right. just
uh-huh. hella, what else makes you horny, Matt?
A lot of things, man.
B.D. Russell was the character's name.
B.D. Yeah. Russell, yeah. yeah. So we open this week's cold open. The testers are late, and fiends are, they are walking around fiending. Testers, by the way, for those of you who don't know, so this is, we're going to do a little bit of Ballmerisms.
Ballmer accents, say this phrase out loud. Earn, earn, and earn, earn. Aaron, earn, and iron, earn. Damn, what the fuck? We really talk like that?
Yo, earn, 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 earn.
Ballmerisms.
But testers are exactly what they sound like. It's literally a little bit of free drugs.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean,
Costco,
that's kind
free
of
sample day.
Yeah, I was going to say, I had no idea that the drug market worked like Costco and Trader
yeah.
Joe's, and it kind of impresses me that they had that level of corporatism and sophistication.
Kind of makes me mad because I feel like the entire time when I was a drug addict, that was not a thing.
You just weren't invited to be a tester.
I know. It sucks, though. I totally would have signed up to be a tester.
The way the testers work is you and your buddy shoot up, and if your buddy dies of some sort of hot shot, you're like, okay, well, I don't want to buy this heroin.
You're
this
like, okay, so that one's a little too strong.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I got some feedback for you. It's like a Yelp review.
It's the libertarian ideal of letting the market decide, you know?
That's right.
Right.
Yeah. Sometimes the invisible hand of the free market ODs and then dies. Mm-hmm. And then you try again. But yeah, all the fiends are fiending and asking Bodhi. And like we talked about, D'Angelo kind of scolds Bodhi for not treating them with respect. And he does this thing where he is directly quoting McNulty from the previous episode, kind of like Tony Soprano would do with his therapist.
Yeah, or Tim would do yeah. with his neighbor on Home Improvement. You know,
on Home Improvement.
He would hear
yeah.
some philosopher's quote that the fence guy told him, and then he would fuck it up later in the episode.
Right, yeah.
Y'all got his tussles, man?
Nigga, it ain't even 9 o'clock and you fiending on it. Get the fuck out of here, man.
Damn. So you just gonna take his money all day and treat him like a dog?
Oh, what? The customer's always right?
Yo, we're in the projects. Can't get these niggas shits, man.
Why not? Shit, everything else in the world gets sold without people taking advantage.
Everything else in this country gets sold without people shooting each other behind it.
Killing each other. Doing each other like dogs. And without all that, you ain't got 5-0 down here on our backs every 5 minutes. That's what they be down here about. The bodies.
I'm here about the bodies.
I like the idealism of D'Angelo here.
Yeah.
You know?
And Bodhi gives him this look. I don't know. It's like pity where
mm-hmm.
he's just like, this guy's living in a complete fucking dream world and he's going to get his ass killed because of it. Because he's like grappling with some shit as if he has never sold drugs before. You know what I
right.
mean? Mm-hmm. Like he hasn't been around this life since he was a kid. He is kind of like, you know, hey, you guys ever thought maybe it would be sick if like we could just sell this and like everything was chill? And I'm sure like every kid in the hood has been like, yeah, that'd be dope. That would be great if that were the case, but it's not now, nor has it ever been the case.
He's also, meanwhile, he's like kind of the kind of manager that you would hope to have, because he tolerates a certain amount of insubordination coming from Bodhi that I feel like a lot of managers would not, like, they'd be keen to assert their authority and be like, no, you got to talk to me a certain way. But he lets Bodhi kind of shit on him while, you know, slowly like trying to deliver lessons to him.
I think he's just like, he is just, I keep saying the word weak, and I don't mean to, you know, like flatten the entire character as just like, oh yeah, D'Angelo, the famous bitch of The Wire.
Right. No, his problem is he's like trying to be the nice guy that we're all taught to be as kids without realizing that is not, that's going to get him killed.
Well, he doesn't like confrontation. He doesn't like, you know, we open the entire series with he's on trial because he shot a guy who just beat him up. Like, it wasn't, he shot someone who he could have just like fought back with his fist, but he went straight to shooting him because he, you know, he can't control his emotions because he's someone who's not built in the same way that I think a lot of people are. Some people can take a beating and some people cry. And he's like me if my uncle was a fucking drug dealer. Like that's exactly how I would be acting. I'm too weak for that game too, so I feel for him.
Yeah, same.
So at that point, Bubbles shows up and does the hat trick, in which he like puts hats on everybody, and you get to see Kima surreptitiously taking photos, which I think is really fucking funny because she mostly takes blurry photos. It's like one of those like details in the show where they're like, yeah, most of these are unusable, and you see her just struggling with the focus. It's subtle, but it's great.
It's not what she trained for, you know?
Yeah, so, you know, that's not something they teach you in the academy, I don't think. In the next scene, we got Daniels and all of these majors meeting with Burrell to talk about, in the previous episode, Officer Przybylowski blinds a kid by cold cocking him with the butt of his pistol. And Burrell's, you know, tells Daniels basically like to rethink field interviews at 2 a.m. And Daniels just, in this scene, he just kind of eats it. Like he knows that.
Can we also talk about like Valchek? I mean, the thing about this show is that like it all feels very authentic. And then when you get a character who is actually like authentically from Baltimore, it's like everyone else immediately pales in comparison.
Yes.
And that's kind of like Valchek shows up and you're like, oh, like that is what a real fucking Baltimore civil servant would be like. Like he's just got that face. I mean, he reminds me of my grandfather. Like he's got that sort of like just sweaty, like greasy, stringy haired and like just certain kind of wrinkles that you get from like smoking and drinking a lot of coffee for like 50 years. And
yeah, he's not like a classically trained actor. He's just a guy they found at the 7-Eleven.
I tried to figure out I tried to find an interview with him and I couldn't find any, but I did find like his own like personally made website and like his IMDb bio. Yeah. And like his IMDb bio is actually one of my favorite things ever. And he linked to it on his own website. So clearly he's proud of it. And his IMDb bio just reads, Al Brown is an actor known for The Wire 2002, Commander-in-Chief 2005, and Fartcopter 2014. Fartcopter. Those are his three.
What is Fartcopter?
I don't know. I haven't looked it up yet. I'm assuming it's a movie about a farting helicopter.
You'll never
something.
Power that helicopter with just farts.
Yeah.
You're crazy.
You're gonna go over the hill there with your farts, and it's not gonna work. He's clearly from the Pennsylvania, Maryland area. He apparently, like, according to his LinkedIn page, he was a director.
You found his LinkedIn?
He was a public affairs officer in the Pennsylvania Air National Guard for 17 years.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's a real guy. Like, because you do see that on the show where you're just like, I know I'm seeing a real guy because.
Yeah, he just immediately smacks of real guy. Like, this instant.
Right. It's like his face, the way he talks, everything about it is too distinctive to be acting.
And, at least now. Like, I could see him in like the Humphrey Bogart days, like he could have been
a character actor.
But now it's just like, oh yeah, people don't really look like this anymore. It's like when I watch old Looney Tunes, and it's probably my favorite thing about Looney Tunes is just Mel Blanc. He does these accents that are just extinct accents, like these thing, like these yeah. very specific types of people from like Brooklyn and Queens and these shit yeah. that Mel Blanc clearly heard growing yeah. up. And like that's kind of what Al Brown's face evokes for me in The Wire.
Sure.
And his accent,
you know, Mel
of course.
Blanc, he also does fake Japanese accent, but it's racist and it's no longer appropriate for television.
Sure.
But
what a talent.
I a Japanese a sapper man, sneaking on with a do. Just a Japanese a sapper man, I'm a little crazy too.
Yeah, I'm glad he's dead, actually.
Yeah. As soon as I saw it, I was like, oof, if he wasn't dead, I'd have canceled his ass to death long ago. But yeah, I don't want to say he's like, oh, he's such a great actor, but his scenes are just, he's so magnetic,
and
Al Brown
it's,
is.
It's hilarious because like at one point, one of the other, I think Santangelo refers to Daniels as that lizard, like the lizard over in Narcotics. And because, you know, like Daniels does look
you
like
look
a lizard.
You look kind of like a lizard. He's got lizardish qualities.
And then you got Valchek, who looks more like a weasel than any human has ever looked. Like he's
right.
he's got like a weasel mongoose look to him.
Yeah, if he had two very long incisors and like long nails and a kind of a hairless tail, you'd be like, "Oh yeah, I got it." Like he looks rat-like to me, which...
yeah. So then it creates this tension in the scene where it's like watching a lizard and a weasel like have this dance where they're trying to fuck each other up, and it's pretty wonderful.
Yeah, yeah, it is. It's that is crazy because it is Valchek versus Daniels is very Cobra versus Mongoose. Mm-hmm. And yeah. You just want to see him fight.
He's like, Officer Przybylowski shouldn't be on the street. And he's like, well, let me tell you something.
It's
like
know
two
he's
different
a
like, schools
of
acting. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a clip of that scene.
I tell you, yes, I screwed up. I tell you, no, I'm putting my men in the jackpot. Do you still want me to answer? I screwed up, sir.
It's a good man that's willing to take one for the company.
I'm defending my own people here. That's all.
What Major Valchek means to say is that he's grateful that you extended your support on behalf of Officer Przybylowski.
Fuck up that he is.
I love that Valchek 100% realizes what a horrible police officer Przybylowski is.
And Przybylowski like, is his son-in-law?
Yeah. He's his son-in-law. Yeah, married his daughter. And, you know, he's basically trying to like get him on the quick path to officer's pay or whatever version of that major's pay, I guess. Like he wants him to go up the ranks quickly so he can do what Valchek does, which is sit at a desk and pull the strings within like the Baltimore Democratic Party or whatever the fucking whatever his non-job is.
It's the it's like the Catholic American dream. Catholic American, their dream is to have, you know, that good, solid union job where you can manage your own fiefdom, where you just got, you know, you got underlings, you got a good solid laborer's job mm-hmm. that you can eventually be in a position of power with.
Yeah.
And he's trying to he wants that for Presbo. I just God, every time I look at him I just see like one of my I see like the Polish version of one of my great uncles, and it's wonderful.
But in this scene Valchek basically says, for kind of like eating this, I owe you one. And he gets some suction. Basically, mm-hmm. Daniels eats a lot to get suction. And
could just go over to Rhonda Perlman's house. You know what I'm saying?
Hey. Want a little suction.
Hey.
Rhonda, I need some suction.
Yeah. I need some suction on this.
Yeah, but like he gets owed a favor by both Burrell and Valchek. And, you know, for Daniels, who's like kind of likes to play middle of the road, like wants to be the good soldier, but also kind of wants to do good police work. Like this is
so
a
he's
kind of
taking the blame for Przybylowski's actions.
Essentially, he's like, you know, I'm gonna coach Presbo through this, and basically get him off the hook for literally blinding someone for no reason. And for that, Valchek is going to give him some suction, which who doesn't want to get some
suction?
That's
all anybody wants in this world.
It's all we want.
Summertime and the living is thirsty. Again. Once again, I've done that joke. And once again, it's a great joke.
Very funny, Matt.
Thank you.
But you're right. It is summer. And during the summer, I love to keep Fiji water on hand to keep my family and me hydrated and refreshed.
Here's the thing about Fiji water. It really is from the islands of Fiji.
You're a liar.
No, I swear to God, it actually is. Drop by drop, Fiji water collects in a sustainable, ancient, artesian aquifer 1,600 miles away from the nearest continent, protected and preserved naturally from external elements. But I'm always wondering, Vince, how does Fiji water taste so good?
That's such a good question. And the answer is that as the water filters through volcanic rock, it collects a unique profile of electrolytes and minerals, resulting in more than double the electrolytes as the other two top premium bottled water brands, giving Fiji water its signature soft, smooth taste. You know, yesterday I happened to take my son to California's largest water park, and you know, it's hot out, the sun's beating down, you're carrying a toddler around, you get thirsty.
Sure do.
And you know what I did?
What?
I reached a meaty paw out for that natural artesian spring water that comes only from Fiji.
That's right. That's right. And listen, I enjoy Fiji water on a hot day. I enjoy Fiji water on a cold day. I enjoy Fiji water on a medium day. Just basically whenever I'm thirsty, I reach for a nice bottle of Fiji water.
I know your mouth gets dry when you're trying to do those royalty freestyles sometimes.
It does. It does. I have a very dry mouth. People have commented on that. And I like to wet it with the Fiji water. And here's the thing, Vince. Unlike some other premium bottled water, Fiji water's electrolytes are 100% naturally occurring.
That's like the best kind of electrolytes. And this water even has a perfectly balanced pH of 7.7. Fiji water really is Earth's finest water. And since 2022, its 330 milliliter and 500 milliliter bottles have been produced in 100% recycled plastic. So you can feel proud of your choice in bottled water.
Get stocked up on Fiji water this summer and visit your local retailer to pick some up today for your next backyard party, beach or pool day, hike, or even your home office.
It's not just water, it's Fiji water.
Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's a great time to save big on everything for your next project at Menards. Get free estimates fast on new energy-efficient windows from Jeld-Wen. Choose from vinyl or wood windows and customize the perfect size and unique features for your home. Save big on all Jeld-Wen windows today. View our entire selection of Jeld-Wen windows on Menards.com. Plus, the weekly flyer for other great deals happening now.
Save big money at
Next thing, we got Rawls giving a press conference about the murdered witness, in which Bunk kind of plays a part of a lackey and is just like, oh, we don't know. Could be anybody, right?
And this is clearly like David Simon's writing here. You can tell that David Simon has covered a number of bullshit say nothing press conferences, because yes, just like the way he writes it is so
perfect.
Good. Yeah.
Pitch perfect in every aspect.
Where they're like, he's like, we know that this is definitely not the result of this guy having been a witness. And the reporters are like, so you know exactly what the motive is, but you don't have a suspect yet. He's like, yes, that's correct.
Yeah. And McNulty is kind of pissed about it. He's like, shame on you, lad, which is this weird thing that it's not just this show. It's a lot of, I feel like, this happened to The Departed as well, where there are people who are Irish Americans who will just randomly be like, I'm doing an Irish accent now. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if anyone actually does a random Irish accent except for us on this podcast.
That's right.
Then McNulty,
Jesus hates it when you lie to the press.
And by the way, they're lying about the witness because it makes them look bad, right?
Right.
They didn't protect the witness.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So they're just going to be like, no, he got killed for some other reason that we don't know about.
We don't know what the motive was or who the suspect is, but we know what the motive wasn't, definitively.
Yeah, it definitely wasn't our fault, which is always true. But McNulty realizes they don't even have a picture of Avon Barksdale yet, and he's their number one guy. And he asks the wonderful Polk and Mahone, my two favorite shitty cops so far in the series, to try to get a picture of Avon, and just tells them exactly how to do the job that they're supposed to do. And just watching them struggle with the idea of ever having to do actual work is really funny.
Hey, Pat.
Huh?
We've got a job for you guys to try to run down.
Need a photo of this guy Barksdale.
Huh? Well, it occurred to me that the housing project began to take photos of every registered resident as a security measure. Am I correct, Detective Greggs?
Yeah.
So you want us to get out of the housing department and pull this photo?
Excellent. You know, you and I, we think as one. We're like two horses together in harness.
Why don't you fucking do it yourself?
Sure, if you don't mind sitting at my desk reviewing homicide folders, taking meticulous notes, I'll switch with you.
Fuck it, Patrick. Let's take a ride.
You know, it took a really long time to make that song.
Right. It was great.
Thank you. I mean, you know, I just...
You're the opposite of Polk and Mahone, because they don't want to do any work. And then McNulty wants to do all the work, and then you want to do a lot of work without accomplishing
anything.
That's right. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. My whole thing is just like maximum effort, minimal effectiveness.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I'm going for. Polk and Mahone have to waddle their asses over to try and get a picture of Avon Barksdale, and it's, of course, not going to work out at all. They show back up a few scenes later with a picture of a white man that they say is Avon Barksdale, because clearly...
visibly Avon, drunk.
Yeah, they show up visibly drunk, first of all. Avon is... He's basically cleared any public record of his image, or so he thinks. But in the scene where they're just talking about what they know about Avon, at one point Kima mentions that he was a like a Golden Gloves boxer, and then we finally see Detective Freeman, who is sitting there quietly making a dollhouse or whatever yeah. shit he does.
That's why he's such a good character. Like he's the guy that you think is not listening, but it turns out he is, and he's just waiting for his moment to pounce.
He's kind of underused, huh?
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely someone who would be an asset in any kind of like police force that, you know, like gave a shit about stopping mm-hmm. crime. Right. Freeman then heads over to a boxing gym, and a kid tries to sell him blue tops, and then he talks to a guy, and when he comes back, he has got a poster with a picture of Avon Barksdale on it, and it is clear that this is the first ever picture that we've seen of Avon Barksdale. This is also, I think, it's possible this is the moment that I, in watching the show, realized which guy was Avon. Because, like I said, it took me a few episodes before I was like, oh, that guy's Avon Barksdale. I thought it was just a name.
Because there's something about Avon Barksdale. He doesn't really look like a drug kingpin in this right. show. He doesn't look like an imposing, like a guy you'd be afraid of. I think Stringer does, but...
Yes.
Yeah.
Avon just looks like a guy.
He looks like a basketball player. Yeah.
Just kind of like a skinny bald-headed guy. And also, I don't think at any point, which I love about this show, at any point, no one is like, hey, what's going on, Avon? And then it's like, nothing, Stringer Bell. You know what I mean? Like, right. they don't do the
That's
thing where
the
they
old,
continue.
That's the Ozark method.
Yeah. Yes.
Hey, it's my old cousin, D'Angelo.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's nice that they don't do that, but it also took me like half a season to realize that that was Avon Barksdale.
He kind of blends in a lot.
Because you don't see him with the money the way you do with Stringer. You know, you don't see him in the pit or in the towers and the high rises, right. like telling different people what to do. You know, it's Stringer is the one who's like, hey, you got to work the pit now.
I mean, you
or
could
he's the one
say,
counting the money.
I mean, you could say that Avon is like the king in a chessboard and that Stringer is kind of like the queen.
You absolutely could say that.
Yeah.
And in fact, in this scene,
I want credit for
Stringer's
that.
The queen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Stringer is the queen, essentially.
He's the get shit done piece.
Right, mm-hmm. exactly. Mm-hmm. He can move any direction, anywhere he wants. I have a clip of that, of the aforementioned chess scene.
And this over here is the castle. It's like the stash. It moves like this and like this.
Dog, stash don't move, man.
Come on, yo, think. How many times we moved the stash house this week?
What about them little bald-headed bitches right there?
These are the pawns. They like the soldiers.
So how do you get to be the king?
It ain't like that. See, the king, stay the king. All right?
All right, but if I make it to the end, I'm top dog.
The pawns, man, in the game, they get capped quick. They be out the game early.
Unless they some smart-ass pawns.
I would have picked a different board game if I wrote the show. I'd have been like, it's called Guess Who. You gotta find the person.
It's Operation.
Yeah.
He's just like,
see, you gotta take this motherfucking bone out of this guy's leg.
And
without
hitting the sides.
Yeah.
Okay.
The stash
so like
is
the
like the funny bone. And see, the police are like these electrified metal pieces.
Right. But Stringer, he's like the lungs. He's always breathing. But you gotta not hit the sides.
Stringer is Lord Licorice. You know what I'm saying?
But I like that they never bothered explaining the knight or the bishops because they're like, all right, we get it. Like, we don't need to stretch
this. Yeah, no, you can't.
Metaphor.
Right. No, yeah, yeah. It'd be great if they just went through the entire board and told you what the knights and the bishops do. And I do realize, I think, that Bodhi is probably my favorite character in this entire series. Like, other than kind of like your... Everyone loves Omar. Everyone loves, you know, McNulty or Bunk. Bunk is fucking great. But, like, I feel like Bodhi has some of the funniest lines in the series.
Well, in this scene, he's slowly learning that the American dream is not real, that you don't get to be the king if you're a pawn. But then he's also... He's flipping it where he's like, okay, but I can still live a good life, right? And
yeah, well, he's basically saying, like, if I live long enough, if I get to the end of the game, can't I become the king? And, you know, he's you know, like, D'Angelo's basically trying to say, you're going to die eventually, which by the, I think is a very, you know, pessimistic way of looking at the drug game. And I think Bodhi is basically saying, you know, I'm just smart enough to survive longer than most of the people on the board. And yeah. I think that may or may not bear out. So let's get to this is the introduction of Detective Sidner. This is the first time we see him. Sidner shows up to complain about the equipment that they have over at the Baltimore City Police. Their wires are literally old reel-to-reels, the size of like a VHS tape. Yeah.
I didn't know what a Nagra was, which is, that's what they call it. Like, oh, we got Nagras?
Yeah, we got Nagras.
So I had to look that up, you know, just a little bit of trivia. Nagra is a brand of portable audio recorders produced from 1951 in Switzerland. Beginning in 1997, a range of new high-end equipment aimed at the audiophile community was introduced. Originally a product of the Kedelski Group, the machines were initially designed by Polish inventor Stefan Kudelski. And his company won numerous technical awards, blah, blah, blah. Nagra means it will record in Polish, Kudelski's mother language. So there you go.
Wow.
Yeah.
Look at that.
Yeah.
We got a little Polish lesson of that. I mean, I just think it's really funny that they would keep around such old equipment that literally, you know, you would easily get caught and killed wearing one of those wires.
Yeah, like, but the thickest wire immediately possible. Recognizable to anyone who is like a public servant in a city that doesn't have a ton of money. Like, of course, yes. Like you're using a text. The teachers are probably using a textbook that's printed in like the 70s.
Yeah,
they're in classrooms that probably still have asbestos in the walls. Like, of course, they're not going to have like brand new audio shit.
Yeah, it's. It's pretty great. They're literally blowing dust off of it, which is great. With regards to Sidner, he has been taken by Daniels to be a part of the detail because they need someone to go undercover with Bubbles to do these like buy busts. And there's a great scene where he shows up to show off like kind of his junkie couture. And he's just like, you know, his ratty jacket and shoes and pants. And I love that Bubbles kind of gives him a lesson on, you know, what it is to actually like look like a junkie.
Yeah, there's a little bit of tension at the beginning of that scene where they're like, can we do this in front of Bubbles? Are we like appropriating his culture as our costume here, or like, is he gonna be mad?
Are we doing black tar face?
yeah,
it is funny, but he's like, I like that he plays the role of consultant. He's just like, as your resident junkie here, I'll tell you that the shoes are not up to standards. I can't do other accents. But
nor should you.
Yeah, nor should I.
But I think I did. I think I did one too this episode.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It's a safe space for everyone here.
Yeah.
To do all their favorite accents. every time I try to do a black accent, I'm just gonna do, well, I'm an alligator from the south, and I feel like that's not racist because it's alligator accent.
Mm-hmm. That's how alligators talk.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know you ain't got no problem with the shoes, fucked up as they are.
You're walking down them alleys of the projects, man. You're stepping on the dead soldiers. Your empty vials. You can't walk down the Baltimore streets without that shit cracking underneath your feet. You want to know if a fiend for real? Check the bottom of his shoes. Have him dance on some empties before we go out there. Get us killed.
You hurt your feelings?
A little bit.
That's such a beautiful, like, Rust Belt slice of life. Like that you're gonna have broken glass on your shoe. I remember I worked with a guy when I was who was from Akron when I was fresh out of college, and he's like, "Yeah, you know Akron. We always say you fall down, you get cut." And I was like, "What does that mean?" He's like, "You know, there's a lot of broken glass." Like, oh, okay. Did not know that about Akron, but now I do.
Yeah, hey, it's part of like the local flavor is
It's broken glass.
Broken glass everywhere.
No one, no one knew how to do
a lot of Jewish weddings.
Broken windows policing there yet.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
I like in this scene, it starts out with, you know, Bubbles is like looking him up and down. And the first thing he does is go like, what's that? And Cinder's like, that's my wedding ring. And it's like, yeah. Well, yeah, obviously take that off. You don't actually need a junkie to tell you to not wear your wedding ring
right.
when you're deep undercover. Yeah. It was just this really weird moment where he's just like, huh? And he gets like offended too. Like Sidner is just like, whoa, maybe I should just do drugs, asshole.
Yeah.
It's just like, first, stop being defensive, dude. He's just telling you how to look the part. Yeah. So Sidner and Bubbles, they head over to the PJs and start a sequence of like, it's like a montage of them buying a bunch of drugs. And for some reason, it opens with like them walking through the pit and someone is playing the song It Takes Two by Rob Bass and DJ Easy Rock. You know, the It Takes Two to Make Anything.
That's still
right.
A bop. I was tapping my foot when that came on.
Yeah, okay, but it's fucking 2002. They're playing like a hit song from 1988. Like, I thought that was the one part where I was like, that's a little off. Oh. They're not going to blast on a ghetto blaster fucking.
No, that's a classic.
I don't know, man. That's the fucking Lose Yourself came out in 2002.
Sure.
Like, there's no way that they're playing fucking It Takes Two. Like, at least play Nas or some shit. But yeah, so they're buying drugs and Kima's taking her blurriest photos and they basically report that they were only able to buy from Hoppers and no one important is implicated. All right, moving on. Deputy Ops Burrell wants them to hit the projects on Wednesday. So basically, it's over. We're going to wrap this shit up, which is a great thing for episode 3 because it's like the idea that there's been maybe 2 weeks of work put into this between these like three episodes. And it's like, and we're done. Right, guys. So they don't know what doors
we're
to hit.
We're three episodes into the show and there is not a wire in the show yet. So,
yeah. Hmm. Yeah. And McNulty's not happy about it. He's pissed off. And he goes over to Rhonda Perlman's house, who's sitting around looking fly, doing law shit. And then she sees McNulty knock, knock, knocking on her door.
McNulty's a fuckboy.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. He's there to fuck. You can see in his eyes, like...
If you thought he was a nice guy, you fucked up.
You fucked up, yeah, because he's going to take the money and run. He is not a nice guy. He is a fuckboy. And he does the most fuckboy thing ever, is he, like, shows up and is like, I'm sorry, I'm here. I'm going to enter your house now. And then when she's like, no, he's like, wait, 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 wait. But I have a law question for you. And shows up, lets himself in, is like, do you know how to clone a pager? And then Rhonda basically tells him, all right, you know, you have to get a judge to sign all of these papers and then, you know, have a supervisor sign off and then you'll be able to clone a pager. And he's like, all right, thank you. And she's like, fuck off, you know you're here to fuck. And they have this great moment together.
Let me understand. You're married and a date is a room at the Best Western with the blinds closed. Now you're single and a date is you coming over unannounced to learn the legal requisites for a pager intercept.
Pretty much.
No.
Okay. I hear you.
Yeah. And then they fuck in unison in a very sexy way.
I love that they made this wheezing sex just like a little bit gratuitous and excessive. I love that.
Yeah, it goes on for a while.
Yeah.
I mean, this is literally, there is a minute left. And I'm not going to play the whole thing because I don't want it to be gratuitous here, but it just, they keep... And it's really kind of hot, but in like a gross way, which is my favorite way.
Who can even last that long?
Yeah.
No one can.
What was impossible. That, like seven pumps? What are you, fucking John Holmes?
Yeah, and then I love that after he comes, he just looks at her and goes, you... which is a great way of asking, did you also come? And then you know, she calls him an asshole to his face right after fucking. I do feel like people are a little bit mean to Jimmy because, like, Rhonda, you don't have to fuck him.
Right.
You know, he's an asshole because you're attracted to him and you want to fuck him right now. And he's he wants to fuck. Mm-hmm. Come on.
You can't resist that. You can't resist that tousled Irish weasel.
Yeah, dude. You got to go for it. Yeah. So, you know, Jimmy leaves having come and then also getting a bunch of papers in which he finds out how he can clone a pager. Then the re-up is late. Dee is getting some takeout and Bodhi wants to get some food.
Yeah. He's getting lake trout, which introduces, you know, our keystone Baltimore delicacy
segment
of the show. Lake trout.
And let me, I made a bumper, dude.
Okay, sweet.
Fried chicken, lake trout. No lake, no trout. Bitch, I'm from Baltimore, you say you
was, I never see you. Yeah.
Okay. Lake trout rolled in cracker meal or cornmeal, fried hard in roiling oil, and served with a pile of cottony white bread and a sluice of vinegary hot sauce is the dish that working class Baltimore craves. I was at Holland's Market the other day, said Dan Van Allen, president of the Araber Preservation Society, a group that celebrates the city's fading horse-drawn vendor tradition. They were selling lake trout and marsh rabbits, but the marsh rabbits weren't really rabbits. They were muskrats. And what they were selling as lake trout was neither a trout nor from a lake.
Damn.
Yeah.
It's imitation lake trout.
Yeah. Query the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and you will learn that the fish known colloquially in the Northeast as whiting is actually silver hake, an ocean-going bottom dweller.
Gross.
A local variation called oyster trout is red hake. I mean, it sounds pretty good. Basically, it's like their version of fried catfish. Sounds delicious. My only criticism is that Bodhi orders a lake trout sub with no mayonnaise, and I'm like, come on, I can't imagine eating a fish sub with no mayo, but like, give me some extra mayo on that personally, but that's just me.
You don't want a dry fish?
No, I don't want a dry fish. I want a moist
you want
fish.
Something moist?
Yeah, with some tartar sauce or something mayo based on
there.
You
got hot sauce with it.
Yeah, I think you need something mayo based in there.
It does. Yeah, it sounds like a recipe for choking. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
Like you go full dry and hot sauce. You're going to die from that.
Yeah, it's no good.
But in that scene, Bodhi has one of my favorite lines after he orders. Poot comes over and is like, oh, wait, was D'Angelo getting food? And this is what happens.
No mayo, extra hot, something to drink.
All right. Yo, he go for food?
Yep.
Why you ain't tell me my stomach drowning like a motherfucker?
Starve, nigga.
That's the coldest thing that has been said on this show thus far. Just like telling him to starve. I love it. Bodhi, we should hang out. You seem cool. So in that scene, the re-up is late and finally Stinkum shows up. And I assume they're in the stash house just cutting it together and putting shit in vials or whatever it is that you do in a stash house. And we finally, after three episodes, introduce fucking Omar. Omar shows up with his shotgun and his partners, you know, that one guy and his lover. They beat the shit out of Stinkum and they shove a shotgun in a dude's face and ask him for the cash, and it is a grand entrance for probably one of the most iconic characters in TV. And I have a clip.
Ain't nothing here, yo.
Fucking hell.
Where that, man? Where that, shorty?
Kitchen, under the sink.
Hey, yo, go on and get that.
G-packs. Let's roll.
Just two.
Yo, Omar, come on. Hey, what the?
In that scene,
that's
they actually
maybe the coolest job that you could have, robbing drug dealers.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know?
It
life
is
expectancy, probably not too long, but
but think
a
of
nice
the freedom.
Feather in your cap.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
no
one
boss,
of those...
beholden to no one. That's the American dream right there.
It
he
really
just keeps
is
robbing them throughout the series.
Yeah, it's a job that I didn't know existed until I saw it on this show. Mm-hmm. Like I
and
knew,
you're like, why didn't I think of that?
Right, I was like, I knew that you could, you know, that robbers, you know, exist. People will rob you, but like the idea of like just strictly robbing drug dealers is like, this is the coolest Robin Hood shit.
I mean, it's like literally everybody else is trapped in this corporate structure where they're, you know, they're stuck between their shitty boss and the public, trapped in this awful corporate structure. Meanwhile, Omar's out here just living the American dream, like a guy out of straight out of a Western, just robbing stagecoaches full of heroin. Like he is fucking Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, just all rolled up and one super cool dude who makes smoking cigarettes look like the coolest fucking thing ever.
Yeah, and being gay.
Yeah, yeah.
Makes being gay look cool, too. Mm-hmm.
Smoking
I think that's
cigarettes and poles.
Yeah.
Yeah, before Omar, being gay was for nerds.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. Now being gay is the coolest thing
awesome.
You can be.
The coolest thing you can be.
Yeah. So Omar shows up. They do say his name, and he is mad about that, I guess, because he wanted to be anonymous. It seems kind of
he doesn't want people to know his name.
Well, it's weird for it's a weird place for the show to start, because it ends up, you know, Omar becomes this like he goes from, hey man, don't say my name, to literally just like walking down the street with a shotgun in broad daylight and people just hiding and throwing their like drugs and money at him.
Well, he goes through, he owns his, once his name's out there, he owns the fact that he's gonna become a legend. And just owns his reputation.
Who'd have thought he was so shy at the beginning? Yeah. I totally forgot that.
But like this, you know, like the Barksdale organization, it shows the limits of nepotism. Like eventually you hire your fucking cousin who is incompetent, but you know, he did not get his job through merit. And you know, same with Omar's got the same kind of troubles where you hire a guy because he's hot and you know, has a nice dick or whatever. And he can be incompetent too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. I mean, but that's a different, you know, that's hiring out of like, I want to say love, but it is kind of just hiring a hot secretary because it's fun to look at.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. He hired a hot secretary and it bit him in the ass because turns out the guy didn't know Excel.
Yeah, he didn't know Excel, not to say his name.
Even though he was Excel.
Yeah,
that's right. Exactly. Irony.
Mm-hmm. So they get robbed, and of course D shows up sandwich in hand and in mouth and is like, what was that van doing? And realizes that he had just missed by a second,
which sucks. Like he couldn't have prevented anything, but like just showing up to the scene of something bad happening and having food in your hand, it's a bad look.
Manager's worst nightmare.
Yeah.
Any middle management person.
I told you to be sweeping when there wasn't work around, and here you're coming in with sandwiches.
And Weebe is pissed about it, is scolding D for not being there when Omar jacked them. And I do feel like it's a little bit much, because it's like, what the fuck was D gonna do?
Right.
Of all people, like Stinkum should have been, you know, had his heads up and been ready for that. But like fucking D, no. D would have gotten his ass kicked. He probably would have gotten his ass shotgunned if he had been there. So it's a good thing he wasn't. And then at that moment, while Weebe is scolding D, the police show up for the aforementioned buy bust scenario to play out. Basically, Daniels has already told everyone, he briefs the detail, we're going to go in guns blazing, we're going to smash through this house, and we're going to get the drugs and take some pictures, and then we're, you know, all good to go. And McNulty is not there. He is noticeably absent because he does not want to do anything that will destroy the case, and he makes Daniels look stupid. And we see one of these like classic McNulty versus Daniels yelling scenes, which are some of my favorite. Because I don't know, just getting yelled at by Lance Reddick feels scary. Mm-hmm. Like even if he's not yelling at me, watching him yell at someone.
Well, that's why that's how you know that McNulty is a true wild card, is that he is not shamed.
He's not intimidated.
Right, exactly.
I'm not going.
You're insubordinate.
I'm not jumping out on something I believe is going to harm the case. If you want to write me up on that, you can't.
You think I want this? I got the deputy ops on my ass for this shit. Now I got you showing me up in front of the whole damn detail.
I don't mean to show anybody up.
Get your vest on.
No.
Motherfucker, if you felt this way, why didn't you call in sick?
I'm not sick.
Write it up. I can't jump out with the rest of my unit because my tummy hurts.
I'm not going to help you gut this case. If you want to pretend to be a police, you go ahead.
You know, McNulty's a real asshole, I got to say.
Yeah.
You
know? Well, but it's like, it's funny. I mean, because this leads into the raid scene. So like in this scene, you could be confused into thinking that The Wire is one of these shows where it's like, okay, all we need is like some good apples and they'll fix some shit. And then we go into the raid scene it's Mahone. Mahone gets punched in the face and he drops like a sack of shit, which is hilarious. And all the cops are like attending to him while simultaneously beating the shit out of the guy who punched him. And they're kicking the shit out of him. And there's this moment where Kima runs over and like your first instinct is to think she's gonna stop this madness. She's gonna stop the beating, but then you realize like no, The Wire is not that kind of show that like makes you feel good about.
She's like, come here, motherfucker! Yeah.
She's like a good cop, but she still understands the assignment, which is that like the number one rule of cops is being loyal to your fellow cops and not like to the ideals of the job or whatever you think it is.
Wrong door.
Yeah.
Yeah. Switched it yesterday.
Fuck out the way. See your hands. Oh, turn your monkey ass around. Put your hands on the back.
Fucking with us. Come on, man.
Oh, Bodie is the one who punches Mahone and immediately gets his ass kicked. And while he's on the ground getting whooped by all these cops, Mahone is on the ground as if he had just gotten shot three times. And Polk comes over and like gives him a drag of his cigarette. He's just like, I'm too weak to get up to smoke. Yeah, have some cigarette. Like these guys.
Get him a cigarette.
Yeah, get him as if he's literally on his deathbed. It is so funny to watch these two cops not know how to get punched in the face. So then McNulty is back in the office reading those papers. The stash house is clean. We find out the press is there. They're like, we'll take a picture of whatever you got. And they have fucking nothing. And you see this look on Daniel's face where he's just like, McNulty, like he's pissed at him, even though McNulty had nothing to do with it. But Lester Freeman does see a phone number and writes it down. So maybe that's going to mean something later. We'll see. And in the final scene, McNulty, he's in his car. He's waiting for his Irish, you know, Fed friend, Fitzhugh? McHugh?
Fitzhugh, something like that. I think so.
And I love the small detail, but, like, they meet in the parking lot, and the Fed has, like, automatic windows, and McNulty has a crank. He lowers this window with him having a shitty car is kind of perfect. And then the Fed tells McNulty that Daniels is dirty and, you know, that he has money, way more money in his accounts than anyone in his job should. And I think in any other show, it would have been like, oh, shit, he's in the game. He's a drug dealer. He is protecting drugs or some shit like that. And in any other show. But in this show, it's like, you know, he probably like stole some money from people back when he used to be an officer, like busting people. He probably just like stole cash from drug dealers, just like every fucking drug cop has done since the beginning of the drug war. Mm-hmm. It's not all that deep. You don't really end up finding out much about Daniel's dirtiness. You just know that he has a past.
Omar should have been a cop. If he wanted to rob drug dealers.
Honestly, it really is, you know, it is kind of interesting that he chose, you know, even that.
He couldn't handle that structure, though. That's all.
No, exactly. He wanted the freedom. You know, McNulty and, you know, Omar are really not all that different. They're both people who like to play by their own rules and fuck whoever they feel like fucking, despite the consequences of it. So
besides Michael Kenneth Williams, have any of these actors since passed away?
I mean, from this episode, I'm not actually sure. Let's see, who's dead. Well, I know that the guy who plays Prop Joe, he passed.
Oh, really? That's a bummer.
Omar, Michael K. Williams. I think.
Yeah, Omar, of course.
Valchek's still alive, which is nice, as far as I can tell.
Oh, that's, we need to get, you know what? We need Valchek on this show.
That's right.
That's what we need.
Yeah.
He would be a great interview. Just him and his weird Pollock face fucking talking about eating cheese or whatever his rat ass does. I'm sorry. and of course the executive producer of the show, Robert Colesberry, he's dead. He died like mid third season or something.
But
That's how the episode ends. You find out that Daniels is dirty this whole time. Is there anything, a scene that I missed or a scene that's your favorite or least favorite that you want to shout out, Vince and Mike?
I just like the stuff with D'Angelo, him lecturing Bodie about, you know, being polite.
Yeah, being polite to junkies.
Yeah. And then regretting that the heroin they're selling isn't very good.
Yeah. I forgot to look up what the song was, but the only like sour note in this episode for me is when McNulty's in the office like writing up reports and he's listening to like some like Brit pop new wave type band. I'm like, I'm sorry, a fucking Baltimore cop in 2002 is not listening to whatever that is.
They do a weird thing with music. Music is probably the biggest oversight, or it's the one part of the show where it loses me a little bit. Like playing It Takes Two in the projects in 2002, and also a bunch of Irish fucking middle-aged cops singing the Pogues at a funeral. You know, or it's like, No.
Yeah.
These guys do not listen to this music. It's just stuff that David Simon likes, and he just wanted to be like, wouldn't it be cool if a cop liked new wave Britpop? But other than that, pretty good show.
Yeah.
I would say my favorite scene is just watching Mahone get punched in the face, because he just goes down.
Yeah. Like the cigarette was incredible.
Yeah. Very, very good. Let's see real quick. The real gangster, getting punched in the face. I don't know. we don't need to do that segment. Here's a question that I think we've been asking a lot. We find out this episode, or at least McNulty finds out, that Kima is gay, that she is a lesbian. The question I have is Bubbles gay? Do we know if Bubbles is gay or not?
I mean, I ask that like every episode. He's sort of ambiguous. Like he's got a thing where he likes to mentor younger, cuter
young
dudes.
Men.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
He could really just like having a mentor protege relationship. It's a little up in the air.
I don't know, man. Who else do you think is gay on the show?
McNulty is deeply closeted.
Oh, I like that. It's a good theory. Because who else is gay?
Slim Charles.
Slim Charles.
I can see that.
That is a really, that's like kind of a gay name.
Yeah.
Plus he's like very, he's fastidious about his look, I think, you know.
Yeah,
cares about his hair and his
hair
his
a lot,
jackets.
Yeah. Who else is gay?
Okay, Matt.
Who else is gay? I don't know. There's probably more gay guys. Anyways, I would say solid B+ episode. Vince, what would you give this episode on a?
I mean, classic solid B+. I think.
Okay, classic solid B+. Mike Racine, what would you give this episode?
I'll go A-.
Fair enough. A- is it's a good grade. If we average all that out, B+, A-, I think we're giving this a solid B+ episode of The Wire. And a solid A+ episode of Pod Yourself, The Wire. Mike Racine, thank you so much for coming back and talking
Thanks
to
for
us
having me. Yeah.
About The Wire, man. Where can people find you on the internet?
You can follow me on Instagram, Mike Racine Comedy, and check out my podcast, Out for Smokes.
Out for Smokes. Check it out wherever you get your podcasts. Patreon.com/Frogcast for all of the bonus episodes where we talk about other things like movies and shit. The $8 tier will get you a shout out. Once again, this is a pre-recorded episode before we release it, so we don't have any $8 tier people yet, but I do want to give a big shout out to Liam, aka Horse from the Discord, for making our logo. Vince, I didn't tell you this, but we had a fan, one of our patrons, Liam, make us a beautiful logo, and I'm very excited
for people
to see it. By the time you're hearing this, you have seen it, and that is Liam's doing. So thank you, Horse, for everything. I fucking love you, bro. Frogcast@gmail.com for all your questions, comments, and concerns. Vince, what is the Google Voice number?
415-275-0030.
All right, everyone. Thanks again so much for listening. And until next time, if you come at the king, you best not miss.
Wire Podcast. The world's only Wire Podcast. Yeah, bitch, this is a show about the wire. And it's also about putting out some fires. It's about war on drugs and the war on terror. It's about lots of things, but it's also about cool guys who sell drugs to their friends and their thugs. And everybody's seeing all the things going on, and no one doing nothing, and no one's ever gonna win, and the war won't end till everyone tries heroin. It's about schools and people who work at the docks and people who teach in schools and the newspaper guys at the end, and also about drug dealers and also about drug users and also about McNulty getting a divorce from his wife. He's not a very good dad, and also he is bad at not drinking a lot, and also this show is about politicians. It was Obama's favorite show. Sucka, 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 yeah, bitch. HBO, The Wire, bitch. HBO Max, I guess. Number one TV show to Barack Obama. What's that say about what Obama likes? It either means that he has good taste, or it means that he watched the show and decided to not do anything when he had the power to change things. But whatever, bruh, that's fine. I wouldn't have done it neither. Probably I'd be too scared to do it.
Suck it, 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 suck it. Zucky, 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 on dick. Licky, 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 on clit. Zucky, 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 fucky, zucky, 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 fucky, zucky, 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 my dick. Omar. The Wire. Matt Lee. Vincentini. Brent Weiberg. David Simon, come on the show.
Episode 3.
Mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.